uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on this beautiful Tuesday, the 19th of... what month is this, Louise? April? April it is! Oh, my goodness. 7 minutes past the hour. Welcome. Welcome to our program. Activism. We talk about activism on this program a lot. And I wanted to get somebody who's really out there doing it in here with us. And Scott Forrester is with the Oregon Public Power Coalition. And he's one of those folks who's out there doing the work. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
It's great having you here in the studio with us. The Oregon Public Power Coalition is a citizens activist group that was put together when to do what?
Oh, about 2.5 years ago, and we wanted to take Enron. You might have heard of Enron.
Yes.
Their largest asset is our former local utility called Portland General Electric, and they still own it. They're out of bankruptcy right now, but they still are trying to sell it. And we wanted to basically take it from them because they proved themselves to be unreliable in their ownership of our utility. And we wanted to make it a public utility with 5 directly elected board members.
Right. And the Oregon Constitution actually provides for the possibility of this kind of thing.
Yeah. Back in the 30s, both labor and conservative folks, the Grange and the AFL, joined together in 1930, got signatures, and it passed overwhelmingly by folks on both the right and left political spectrum. To allow for the creation of a public-owned utility at any time in the state.
Yeah, you think of the Grange as coming from the right?
Well, I think now maybe back then it wasn't way.
The Grange came out in the 1870s, 1880s, and it was the small farmers' movement against the Cargills and ADMs of the day. These big agricultural combines were conspiring with the railroads.
That's right.
To fix prices on agricultural products. And so these small farmers banded together and created the Grange movement, and it was part of the populist movement.
I think as a relatively young person and not as scholared in history as you...
You don't remember 1880?
Well,
Scott!
The Grange now, let's say, is a lot more conservative, but
yeah,
I actually talked to the folks there, and many libertarians and Republicans are supporters of public power because they like power at cost.
The modern-day Grange, because the modern-day Grange is still intact.
Grange, the Oregon Grange is one of our chief... co-sponsors, you know, or having endorsed us. We went there and had a Republican go make a pitch, and they said after 70 years, it's still a good idea. And so we had people in the right and left political spectrum saying public power is a good idea.
This is great. Scott Forrester of the Oregon Public Power Coalition. Scott, do you have a website, by the way?
Cheappower.org.
Cheappower.org, so people can see what you're doing and what you're up to. How did you get into this?
Well, I was actually into water issues, municipal water. We have this superlative system called the Bull Run Reservoir, and it's over 100 years old, publicly owned. And for the last 10 years, we've been trying to, as people need to do, citizens need to be guardians of their things that are owned for and by the public. And there were certain attempts over time to do logging in the watershed, which would diminish water quality. So the Forest Service looked at the trees not as a way of filtering the water, but actually as just money on the stump. That led to eventual concepts of privatization of our water supply, and we kind of beat that back a little bit. And then all of a sudden, of course, Enron hit the papers, and everybody started paying attention to electric utilities. And I was unaware of the constitutional provision. Sometimes there's little clauses in the Constitution that sit there for decades and nobody knows.
Right.
We dusted it off, re-educated ourselves.
What does this thing say?
And found out that those old timers, you know, 70 years ago had it right. And we found then, since history, about every 20, 25 years, citizens rediscover this clause and try to exercise
every generation.
It seems
every generation discovers it anew and tries to do it. And that's in Oregon. Do you know if there are other clauses in other constitutions around the United States?
I haven't done the research on that, but I know that Oregon is blessed to have the initiative and referendum process. In fact, I think we're one of the strongest, earliest advocates of that.
Yeah, which also came out of the progressive and populist movements that again started in the 1870s, 1880s, and really reached their full power in the 1920s, I'd say, you know, by and large. And then this kind of morphed into the Democratic Party, actually, in the 30s under FDR. It just all pulled together. Hopefully it'll do it again, Right. We'll have. Wouldn't it be nice to have a political party that's actually concerned about the interests of we the people?
Well, that's very interesting, because the Oregon Democratic Party actually has in its platform, it advocates the conversion of Portland General Electric into public power. It doesn't say exactly what kind.
Right.
That's a major change. But what we're having trouble with, we collectively, citizens, are having trouble getting both Republicans and Democrats to come out publicly in favor of public power. Because of the political influence of money, and as you imagine, Enron, according to records, was the largest campaign contributor to both Republicans and Democrats in the state of Oregon, and we're only one of a handful of states that don't have any
the
campaign
finance
limits. The
largest in the state?
Per person and overall... overall giving.
In which year?
By any corporation. I believe it was as of 2 or 3 years ago, the data that I was aware of.
So this is probably the 2000 election.
Prior to them crashing and burning. But so they were real adept at spreading the money around on both major parties.
Yeah.
And so what we found then is that even though the Democratic Party of Oregon has this in their platform, the actual elected officials were nowhere to be found. We had a few private statements saying, hey, good luck to you, but I'll never say anything in public.
Yeah, we're talking with Scott Forrester of the Oregon Public Power Coalition, a group of citizens who got together and said, hey, this strange idea that maybe the purpose of government and the purpose of government functions and the purpose of government organizations is for we the people to take care of we the people. For us to say, hey, you know, there are some things, but there's a lot of things that it's really best be done by private industry. We don't want the government making our shoes. I've been in the Soviet Union back when it was the Soviet Union. You don't want to be wearing their shoes. We don't want the government making our cars. I forget the name of the East German cars, the Tatis or something like that. They were horrible. They were just unbelievably bad. We don't want the government doing those things. I mean, there's a place, a large place for private industry. But when it comes to things that have to do with our survival, our ability to drink pure water, our ability to have electricity on, our ability to have health care, in my opinion, which is a little digression from this topic, but those things that have to do with our survival, historically, I mean, going back to 1776, and of course going way back before that, I mean, going back to the Magna Carta back in 1015 or 1215, historically we have said these are functions of government to provide for we the people. So you guys got together and you said, okay, we the people are supposed to be taking care of this. Our politicians sold us out to Enron. When did that happen, by the way?
Enron bought Portland General Electric in 1997, and it was authorized by our Public Utility Commission.
Yeah.
Now, in hindsight, you know, there were warnings. There was a lawyer named Dan Meek, who might be a great guest in the future. He actually sat before the Public Utility Commission and warned them, and I'm paraphrasing, that basically it was... a shell game. He mentioned these offshore corporations and gave them dire warnings in 97, and in the fullness of time, he was proven absolutely correct.
But Ken Lay knew nothing about this.
No, actually, Ken came and testified, and what was really interesting, too, is that they did something rather novel. Many environmental organizations, mostly mainstream groups, including the Natural Resources Defense Council, actually testified admiringly on behalf of Enron.
You're kidding.
Here in a very environmentally sensitive state, it was necessary to have some greenies there sitting at the table. And they testified wonderfully.
NRDC?
Yes, absolutely.
Seriously?
They're not very proud of it now, but...
why? How did they get the wool pulled over their eyes, or did somebody get paid off, or what?
Well, it was basically, my understanding is there was a memorandum of agreement between maybe 8 to 10 environmental and social justice organizations that basically got a certain amount of money in payments, I believe, to a foundation that they would use as money in their operations for good causes. And although it might not be a direct payment, it was such that it looked like a quid pro quo.
The proverbial road to hell that's paved with good intentions.
And well, that Enron was the master at basically greasing the wheels of progress. And here in Oregon, to have some environmentalists there at the table with you was good. But now none of those environmentalists are to be found advocating for Enron right now.
Yeah, surprise. that's a good thing. So how do you get people involved in this? The lesson that I want our listeners to carry out of this thing, and the thing that I'm really most interested in, you're helping our listeners get over the next 3 or 4 minutes here that we have in this segment, is how do you get people on the ground involved? How do you get them to show up for meetings? How do you get them active? How did you folks take this from, you know, a couple of people looking at the Constitution saying, hey, we got an idea here, to where now you have the city of Portland and the state competing with each other over which government entity is going to buy this public utility and run it for the people rather than have it be run by a private corporation? I mean, it's just an absolute reversal of the whole Reaganomics, Bushonomics, if corporations do it, that's the way it should be, blah, blah. You know, how do you do that?
Well,
what's your advice for somebody in Denver, Colorado?
Well, first off, get yourself an Enron. Enron was the poster child for corporate abuse, and so a lot of our heavy work was done. There was a frustration built up among the citizens, and we cashed in on it for the public good. Now, you know, 3 years ago, we were in the wilderness crying about the benefits of public power and local control and electricity at cost.
Right.
And now we do have the state legislature arguing over a bill about trying to buy Enron's PGE subsidiary. And we have the city of Portland that for the last 2 years has been a competitor of us in a friendly way. We support them. And now they are in the driver's seat. We really have an opportunity here where the city of Portland as a municipality might for the first time in 100 years convert from an investor-owned utility to a public utility, and they're going to have things like windmills and renewable energy as a focus and really turn the economy around.
Right.
Here.
So how can somebody in Detroit, Michigan, or in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, or in Carbondale, Illinois, or in Eureka, California, how can somebody in San Antonio, Texas, in someplace like that, you said get yourself an Enron. I suspect there's no shortage of these things in not necessarily just in, I mean, we're talking about electricity here, but for example, hospitals. Bill Frist has made a fortune. His family has made hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. I mean, the largest fine that his family's business got was a $800 million fine for ripping off the government. So you've got an Enron there in the Frist family business. So somebody's got a local hospital. They want to take it public. How do they do it?
Well, I think the first thing is get accustomed to your laws, acquainted with your laws and what your ability has. Find a good attorney. They're hard to find, you know, ones that are public interest attorneys that don't charge you a lot of money, but they're there, usually overworked. You don't necessarily need an Enron. I think one in six electric utilities are publicly owned throughout the United States. There is the right. American Public Power.
So five out of six are privately owned?
I believe so. That's the
wow.
stats I was looking at. Now, the American Public Power Association, APPA.org, is a thing where they kind of justify one public ownership's benefits and also give you a how-to guide, maybe not as perfect as it could be on a state-by-state basis. But if you look at Snohomish PUD or SNOPUD.org, they're the ones that secured the tapes from the Justice Department where you hear these guys, these energy traders from
right.
Enron making fun
yeah.
of the mom
yeah.
grandmother.
So you,
down
so you
in
get
California.
The story out and you move it along. We've got to wrap this up.
Okay.
But Scott Forrester, thanks so much for being with
Thank
us.
You
the
for your time.
Website again was
cheappower.org.
Great. Thanks a lot. 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Linkball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Link.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, a true people's radio. ODAC warns of global shortage of oil after 2007. Speaking of energy, ODAC is the Oil Depletion Analysis Center. It is an international consulting group based out of the UK, I believe. And they are saying that we are going to see a worldwide, as in global, a global oil shortage starting 2007-2008, maybe sooner. And we're already seeing the early symptoms of it in these explosions in oil prices. Keep in mind, when George W. Bush came into office, oil was selling for more or less under $20 a barrel. Now it's over $50. Last year, they note, global oil demand grew by 3.3%, largely fueled by China. And if demand continues to rise at this rate, then by 2008, the world will face a shortfall of 1 million barrels a day. This is no small amount. New field development timetables slip. The world could face a supply shortage as early as 2007. See, right now, we are producing about 1 million to 3 million barrels a day more, or the world is capable of producing more than it consumes. And so, you know, the folks in Saudi Arabia, they can just open a spigot a little more. Or if we can get our, if we could, you know, calm down Iraq, we could get another, we're getting about, my recollection is we're getting around 1.5 million barrels a day out of there right now. Wolfie had said that we would be getting 2 to 3 million barrels a day. With development over a 5, 10, 15-year period, Iraq is capable of producing as much as 6 or 7 million barrels a day, although that's not happening real fast. But in any case, there's that. Then there's the second largest supply of oil in the world. Iraq is the third. The second largest supply of oil in the world is Iran. And Iran has been, you know, kind of going it slow, but they're now cutting deals with China and some of the European countries and Japan to provide oil, which is making politicians, Bush administration politicians, a little nervous. They're saying, oh, well, wait a minute, how can we attack this country if they've got strategic relationships with all these other countries? But the day is coming. And, you know, it's absolutely amazing. Today's Wall Street Journal, the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the, as I recall, there was, I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is that I was on the front page, this article about how GM is, like, been taken by surprise. Gee, we didn't see this thing coming. Our earnings are slipping. All they have to do is try and buy a Toyota Prius, and they would get it. They have been, people, you know, yes, let's keep making gas guzzlers. We have been here before, my friends. Here you have the Republicans in Congress saying we're not going to increase the corporate average fuel efficiency, the CAFE standards. We're not going to increase those so that less fuel is used, but instead what we're going to do, we're just going to, you know, give $8 billion in welfare to the oil industry, to the energy industry. We're going to give them $8 billion, you know, they wanted to give them $20 billion 2 years ago, last time they tried this. Now it's down to $8 billion. That's what we're going to do. We're going to give this money to the oil companies. And in the meantime, Americans are starting to wake up. Hey, gas is $2.50 a gallon now, more or less, all around the country. And it would be nice to have a car that got more than 8 miles to the gallon. People just can't afford to drive gas guzzlers anymore. And General Motors is going, well, you know, we didn't see this coming. And this just has to be one of the biggest failures of corporate management. It should have been just so obvious, just so absolutely obvious that this is coming. And it's time to start making some smaller cars or some cars that are more fuel efficient. You know, everybody is not looking for the testosterone charge of the, I got a mighty SUV here. That's, you know, it's just not, it's not the market anymore. Things are changing in America. Speaking of privatization, corporate power, all these kinds of things, Japan and China, this is a huge cautionary note. I share this with you right after the break. This is Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Why does the sun go on shining? Why does the sea rush to shore?
Well, because if that's what nature does, you know, it just keeps going on and on and on. Well, maybe you're in love with her, but, you know, that's... The sea keeps on shining. Welcome back to our program. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert Bob had said in the chat room, which you can get to by going to tomhartman.com, by the way, he said, Tom, do you think that the General Motors losses will precede a new recession and or worse? Yes. And we are in it. We have been in it for 3 years, a recession. My concern is that it is the or worse part. And if the history of conservative economics. Every time the kind of economics that have been played out by Reagan, Bush Sr., in terms of international behavior, Clinton, although his domestic behavior was quite good, and Bush Jr., every time that we have had these kinds of policies, economic policies and trade policies in the past, it has led to a disaster, to just an absolute disaster. We saw it in the Great Depression of the 1840s, 1850s. We saw it in the Great Depressions in the 1930s. We saw it in the panics and recessions or depressions, whatever you want to call them, of 1893, as I recall. Somewhere there in the 1890s, it was a terrible time that was really not all that different from the 1920s. It just, you know, isn't in the memory of this generation. It didn't get named. So if we look at the history of conservative economic policies, those times this country has been ruled by those people who are working aggressively to create an oligarchy, who are working aggressively to create single-party rule, and the component of that party which is ruling is that which wields the most economic power, then, yeah, there's a dangerous history there, Robert Bob. And it concerns me a lot. It really and really, 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 really does concern me a lot. Rama points out, they raised taxes to a responsible level vis-a-vis spending, H.W. Bush and Clinton. And they did. And even Reagan, actually. You know, Reagan had his huge tax cut. When John Kennedy came into office, the top income tax bracket was 90%. He cut it down to 70%, and he said very clearly the reason why he was doing that was because nobody was paying the 70 to 90%. And he would know, he came from a family that would have been in that income bracket. He said, nobody's paying this. There's too many loopholes. So let's close the loopholes for the very, very rich, because they were paying less than 70%, and set it at 70%, and will actually increase tax revenues. And they did. And they didn't increase tax revenues because of increased economic activity. I mean, the economy was growing, but they increased tax revenues because they increased tax revenues. They closed loopholes. But the cons say, oh, look, Kennedy took it from 90% for the millionaires and the billionaires, took it from 90% down to 70%, and more money came into the government. It helped reduce the deficit. So let's take it from 70% down into the 30s. So Reagan does that. But he didn't close any loopholes. He didn't do it in a way that, you know, let's make sure that those who are getting the greatest blessings of society are also, you know, paying something commensurate with those blessings. Didn't do that. And so what did we end up with? We ended up with this enormous debt. And Reagan himself realized that he had blown it, or his advisors did, certainly. I doubt, frankly, that Reagan was sufficiently sophisticated to get the micro or macro economics of the situation. But nonetheless, he raised taxes six out of his last eight years. But he was, you know, they called him the Teflon president. I mean, he did it. At the same time, he was going out and preaching against it.
Say, we've got to cut taxes. We can't have tax increases. By the way, guys, pass this through Congress, would you please? What can you say?
The larger issue that I, this really, really concerns me. And we need to be paying attention to this. An article in today's paper, this from the L.A. Times, Washington Post wire service. This is probably in your local paper, wherever you may be located. The headline is an article by Mark Magnier, M-A-G-N-I-E-R, Magnier, maybe? I don't know. In any case, Mark wrote this. The headline is Japan-China talks conclude with tensions still high. And the Dateline Beijing, Japanese Foreign Minister Nobutaka Nakamura on Monday wrapped up a two-day visit to China aimed at halting the recent freefall in relations between the two nations, but left with little to show for the talks. Beijing remained noncommittal over Japan's request for a meeting between Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi and Chinese President Hu Jintao. Now, get this. This sounds like some sort of a dry, oh, you know, isn't that interesting? No, what does that have to do with me kind of thing? But just think about this for a minute. Here you have one of the three or four most powerful, economically most powerful nations in the world, Japan, next door to China. And these guys are having a spitting war right now over their textbooks. The Japanese say that the Chinese are not characterizing them well in their textbooks, and they're covering up their own genocide and their whitewashing and all this kind of thing. And the Chinese are saying that the Japanese are not acknowledging the rape of Nanking and the 1894 when they first started the first Sino-Japanese War, and 1931 when the Japanese invaded Manchuria and held it as a puppet state until 1945. What's referred to as the rape of Nanchin, the massacre, 300,000 Chinese killed by the Japanese army in 1937 and 1938, or the Second Sino-Japanese War, this is also known as World War II, 1937 and 1945. The Japanese textbooks just kind of downplay this a little bit, so the Chinese are all upset. And what's happening is all around China, the Chinese media has been whipping this anti-Japanese sentiment. The Chinese newspapers, these evil Japanese, look at what they did to us, and now they won't even admit it. And so Japanese factories in China are being picketed. The employees of Japanese companies in China are being harassed and threatened. About 10,000 Japanese tourists have canceled trips to China. They are scared, says Ito Keiji, Culture, Education, and Press Minister with the Japanese Embassy in Beijing. Takashima expressed Japan's hope that China would better safeguard Japanese offices, factories, and nationals, quote, so anxiety and worries by Japanese and many in the international community would be wiped out as soon as possible, end quote. In other words, the Japanese are finding, they've been trying to make use of this cheap Asian labor, the cheap labor in China. And the Japanese companies are finding, China is now wealthy enough and powerful enough, in large part because of the economic policies that have been pursued, not just by the United States and the Bush administration, but by the Chinese as well, to say to the Chinese, you guys take a hike. We don't need you. Out. The Chinese are saying to the Japanese. And this, broadly speaking, not a good thing. Not a real healthy thing. Not a good plan. Now, what happens when China says that to us? Well, you think China is our ally? You think China's on our side? You think China really cares about the United States? I have a bridge to sell you if you do. So this is just being played in the media like a small story. But all of our trade policies and our multinationals have handed to China enough political and financial power to tell Japan and eventually the United States to take a leap. And I'm telling you, this is going to happen to us next. We are naked with regard to China. We have stripped ourselves bare. We can't make a missile without chips from China. We have not only exported jobs, we have exported entire industries to China. During World War II, it was like, women didn't wear nylon stockings so that the nylon could be used to make parachutes. Well, we're probably getting our parachutes from China right now. Could we even field an army if we didn't have Chinese goods? We don't have a textile industry for all practical purposes left in the United States. Our American flags are made in China. And the Chinese now telling the Japanese, much to the shock of the Japanese, you guys take a hike. Our president doesn't want to talk to your prime minister. Thank you very much. 10,000 Japanese tourists too afraid to go to China. Japanese-owned factories in China not safe. We are only in the United States making 16% of what we consume in this country. Reagan and Bush. And to some extent, Bill Clinton have sold us down the river to these folks. And it's a dictatorship. The genocidal dictatorship. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Spike in Easton, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Spike, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to hear from you there, Tom. I haven't talked to you since you moved. I hope it all went well.
Well, it's still going. The mover is actually showing up this afternoon to deliver our furniture. We've been sleeping on an air mattress, but we're here.
Real quick, two guests I'd like to hear you interview sometime for an intelligent interview and a quick question. I would love to hear an intelligent interview with you for the local events and news of the day with Phil Donahue and Jesse Ventura. I think they both would be great interviews.
Oh, that's an interesting suggestion. Okay.
Noted. Okay, and also, real quick, I don't have internet access anymore, so I can't look this guy up. Every night in my local news, there's commentary from this neoconservative whack job. He's always spreading lies. He's even claimed at one point for 48 hours he was considered for Dan Rather's job before they picked Dan Rather. His name is Donald Barnhouse, and even if you don't know about him, if one of your listeners could just inform us, who is this Donald Barnhouse who I've never heard of him. Yeah, that's why I don't understand how he was considered for Dan Rather's job. That was probably his biggest lie that I've caught him in. And I would certainly love if somebody out there could just tell us who this Donald Barnhouse whack job is that he just infests my local news every night. And, you know, I'd love one night for the Michael Moore commentary to come, but it doesn't seem to come. It's always Donald Barnhouse, sadly. But I guess that's the liberal media for you.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. I don't know. By the way, Spike, we have a new pope.
Is he the German fella?
Yeah, that's right, Ratzinger. Ratzinger.
What
this means is the Catholic Church is going more conservative than they have been. He was the enforcer for Pope John Paul II.
I heard rumors, I don't know how true this is, I heard rumors that as a child in Germany...
He was in the Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, that doesn't indict him. I have to say, having lived in Germany, and by the way, if you haven't seen the movie Downfall, go see it. It's about the last days of Hitler. If you were a child in Germany during the last 2 years of the war, you were in the Hitler Youth, period. I mean, it was just that simple. So
yeah.
So the fact that he was in the Hitler Youth, or the fact that actually for a short while, apparently he was, thanks, Heidi, for a short while, apparently he was even manning a machine gun, you know, an anti-aircraft thing or whatever. I mean, they were literally, if you were 10, 12, 14 years old and you were not in the Army, they would shoot you. Or if you were 60 or 70 and you were not in the Army, they would shoot you. You were considered a deserter. You would get hung or shot. I mean, people just had no choice in the matter. So, Scott,
well,
go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call, and certainly long live Hunter S. Thompson.
There you go, Spike. I called you Scott. Thanks a lot, Spike. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Paul in Central Missouri on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Morning, Tom.
Morning.
Member of Teamster Local 600 in St. Louis, Missouri. So therefore on the same side of the fence, if you will.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned a few minutes ago about the eventual Chinese backlash against America.
Well, it's happening on a kind of sneaky level right now. I mean, they're cutting all these side deals with all these other countries. They're getting ready to push us out. They're already threatening Taiwan, and we've already backed down. So.
Well, what was their response to John Snow about Secretary of Treasury John Snow about 3 months ago when he asked them to revalue the yuan?
That's right. That's right. And they said, well, yes, we'll consider that. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when they're going to revalue the yuan, they're going to revalue it when they can do so in a way that causes the dollar to crash. I mean, they're not going to do it. They're going to do it on their timetable, not on ours. And Bush keeps thinking the Chinese are going to pull his fat out of the fire, that they're going to save the day or something. And they may be doing it for the multinational corporations over the short term. But over the long term, I mean, the Chinese, I mean, all they have to do is tomorrow morning say, OK, all these computer factories here in China, we're nationalizing them. We now own them.
Sure.
And boom. And by the way, we're not going to sell anything to the United States anymore. And it would be more devastating than certainly more devastating than Pearl Harbor. I mean, that was just, you know, a terrible thing, but it was just basically, you know, bombing a couple of warships. I mean, that would wipe us out economically. It could all of a sudden Walmarts would be empty all across America. Maybe there's an upside to this, facetiously. No, you're absolutely right, Paul.
A question, one more.
Sure.
What is your take on the relationship, the growing relationship between India and China?
Well, India and China are seeing each other as essentially allies for the moment, strategic allies, in that they are both rapidly developing countries that are sucking the blood out of the United States. Or now, actually, they're down to kind of breaking the bones and sucking the marrow out of the United States, taking the last of our jobs, most of our resources, and selling us, you know, in the case of India, services, in the case of China, goods. And they're gonna ride that horse as long as the Bush family and their buddies in Congress and the multinational corporations will keep handing us over to them. And then when finally America wakes up, as soon as there's some little bit of protectionist legislation or something that puts an end to this thing, I have a feeling that China and India will become competitors rather than cooperators, because they're competing for the same resources. They're both looking for oil. They're both looking for, you know, European markets, things like that. So, yeah, I not next week. I'm talking 5, 10, 15 years down the road. But
well,
yeah.
our military presence and long-term military presence in Iraq versus where it used to be stationed in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's a mess. It's just a mess. Paul, I gotta go. We're out of time. Thanks for the call, though. I do appreciate it.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful and comfortable, 'cause we were powerful and in control. Then Daddy's judges came through and they appointed me the president with no precedent, Pennsylvania Avenue resident.
Yes, indeed.
So I entered a world that was full of complexity, far too much for me. I never got beyond dichotomy. How ironic it was that I would lead a democracy without diplomacy, in many ways an aristocracy.
Yes, it's the George W. Bush song. Welcome back, my friends. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky is on the line with us. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Oh, I just wanted to see, I listened to you, I listened to Lou Dobbs, and just frustrated with both parties.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, I don't see any change or any hope for change down the road right now. I don't see any possibilities of us getting out of this. We can't turn, the ship is too big to turn.
I'm not sure that you're right. Dennis, I think we're gonna go through a rough patch here, but I have a feeling that this rough patch is gonna do the same thing to these guys, to Bush and DeLay and Hastert and Frist, that it did to Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter, you know, to his credit, I mean, he was doing everything he could, but he had the Fed working against him, and he was dealing with, you know, 12 years of Reaganomics and Bushonomics having devastated the economy. And he tried to clean it up. He couldn't. He got blamed for it. Reagan comes in, makes things. It was just a disaster. And.
Well, what can we do?
Well, it's, you know, what can we do?
Are there any parties or any groups? You know, the Reform Party was the last party that I remember.
I believe that what we need to do is we need to be taking over the Democratic Party. That's what we need to do. We need to infiltrate and take over the Democratic Party. We're not going to make it through to the Republican Party. They have totally sold out to the multinational corporations. They are no longer available. The Democratic Party, though, I say only about a third of it is gone. Only about a third of it is totally in corporate hands.
This is my problem. This is my only problem. Some of us, I think it is a distraction, but it's a grave concern, some morality things like abortion. And, you know, whether or not you see it as a morality issue or not.
But see, that's the point. If that's a morality issue for you, get inside the Democratic Party and make your point. I mean, ultimately, that's it. I mean, if you have a concern about that, I have a concern about trade, whatever. If we get in there and take over the party, then we can make it what we the people want it to be. Yeah.
Okay.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio, where we dare to ask that incredible question, is Walmart a person? Are they? What do you think, Heidi? Are they? Is it a person? No!
We'll be back. You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. You are right smack dab in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here, exposing the con in conservative day after day. We have with us today Suzanne Gordon, an award-winning journalist and the author of six books, including Life Support, Three Nurses on the Front Lines, co-author of From Silence to Voice, What Nurses Know and Must Communicate to the Public. Hey, Suzanne. Whoops. Up there. Let's try it again. Push the button, Tom. Hey, Suzanne.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. How are you? How are you today? What's up?
I'm great. Thank you.
I am so pleased to have you on here. You have been there. You're the daughter of a doctor. You have been a nurse yourself. You've written several books about this. You're an astute observer of this. Why? First of all, one of the questions that really piques my curiosity, 17% of registered nurses in the country are unionized, even though a much higher percentage of that of nurses than that live in places where they have an opportunity to join a union. What's the challenge there?
Well, before I answer that question, Tom, I just want to clarify. I'm actually not a nurse. I'm a journalist, and my new book, Nursing Against the Odds, How Healthcare Cost-Cutting, Media Stereotypes, and Medical Hubris Undermine Nurses in Patient Care, deal with the nursing crisis that's going on today, and it's in this context that I raise the issue of the nursing shortage that we have, the fact that more people are getting sicker in our societies and living longer with more problems, but we have fewer people, or we don't have enough people going into nursing, so we're not replenishing the supply.
Right, but you are the daughter of a doctor.
I am the daughter of a doctor.
I'm getting the bio right here.
Yeah, I am the daughter of the doctor, but I'm not a nurse. I've been writing about nursing for about 18 years, and this new book, Nursing Against the Odds, is kind of a culmination of stuff I've observed and concerns I've had because of the way our society treats nurses. And, you know, that leads to the question that you asked about unions, because nurses' wages have stagnated for the past 12 years or so. Their working conditions have eroded. Many are working, I mean, for most nurses, the 40-hour week is a thing of the past, so is the 8-hour shift. They're working, you know, 12 hours, 14 hours a day because they have so much work and so many sick patients, and they're taking care of more and more patients who are sicker and sicker. And the people who really raised the alarm about this first and most systematically and also just pretty much won't give up on it are nurses and unions. And they do that because unions provide people with protections that other workers don't have, because, as you know, there's no freedom of speech in the workplace. And
well, unions, Suzanne, unions essentially are democracy in the workplace. I mean, that is the whole point of it. So
yeah, and they're democracy in the workplace, and the point is that there is no democracy in the workplace because there are no constitutional protections for free speech in the workplace. You know, most people, you know, they hear that an employee can be fired at will. You know, that your boss can come in a workplace and say, you know, Tom, I don't like your outfit, or, you know, I don't like what you said to me yesterday, and boom, you're gone. And most people think, oh, gee, you know, they can do that, and you have to tell them, yeah, they can do that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that, you know, if a nurse raises the issue of patient care to an employer, you know, that they're going to listen. And the problem is that if they're cutting nursing staff and they're under all the financial pressures that the hospitals are under today, and they are making some unwise decisions and cutting nursing staff, people think that the nurse can, you know, go tell the employer about the dangers, and that they can do that and not get fired. And unless you've got a union.
So back to the question, Suzanne, why are only 17% of nurses unionized?
Because most people in this country have bought the line, or certainly most professional people have bought the line that, you know, that it's unprofessional to be in a union.
That it's a blue-collar thing, you mean?
Yeah, and a lot of nurses are very worried about their status because, you know, they haven't been sufficiently valued and respected.
That's absolutely bizarre. I mean, you know, we lionize, for example, actors, and they're almost all members of the union.
Absolutely, and you know, a lot of polls show that we trust nurses and we think that nurses are ethical and honest, but that doesn't mean that we really understand the kind of work that they do and how important it is and how difficult it is and the knowledge they need. So this creates this lack of understanding of what nurses really do, creates a kind of professional inferiority complex. And so you mention a union and people who are worried about their status and legitimacy already are going to get even more worried because, oh my God, you know, that's like a blue collar worker.
Somebody's going to think
we're a truck driver.
Yeah, that's absolutely tragic that there's that perception, Suzanne. And I would hope that the nursing unions would be working on changing that as quickly and as they possibly can.
Well, they're working on changing that, and they're also working very hard on changing the conditions under which nurses work.
Let me talk about that for a minute. You mentioned that there are we are short 126,000 nurses, or 12% of RN capacity in the United States.
That's a figure that of the American Hospital Association, and that figure is a couple years old. But I mean, there's a fair, you know, in some states it's worse than that. In some states, it's slightly better. In Massachusetts,
right?
Where
to finish the question, we have Bill Frist's family, which has made hundreds of millions of dollars now by taking public hospitals private and squeezing them as hard as they can. To what extent, and I remember growing up in the 50s and 60s and even in the 70s, when the laws were in most states that a hospital had to be a not-for-profit corporation because its first job was to provide health care. And if you were going to, if you wanted to make money, go make shoes or something. But if you want to provide health care, it has to be a not-for-profit corporation. When these laws started changing under Reagan and Bush, we saw families like the Frist family buying up formerly not-for-profit hospitals and cranking down on them and squeezing the money out of them, basically, and becoming millionaires, multimillionaires, hundred millionaires, billionaires. And to what extent is that privatization of the hospital industry now in the United States over the past 20 years responsible for this nursing shortage?
Well, I think the major problem that caused the nursing shortage, privatization and the for-profit companies don't help, but the real problem is our private insurance industry and the fact that most health insurance comes through employers. So if the employers stop wanting to pay as much for health care, which they have to do because there's 1,500 different health care plans or more, you know, and you have a lot of money being taken off the top of the health care dollar for administration, marketing, and profit. So if that kind of thing is going on, that means that, you know, the people want more money for profit and marketing and so forth. And they're competing, you know, there are more insurance companies competing against each other. So that's more money, you know, going to that. So that raises the cost of the premiums and then the employers don't want to pay that. And so what they did was they introduced this thing called managed care, or what I call mangled care. And that was really what started the kind of hospital restructuring that went on then in the 1990s, where hospitals were under pressure to cut costs, and they did it in part on the backs of nursing care. They started laying off experienced, educated nurses who were more expensive and started replacing them with unlicensed aides and so forth, and that really created serious problems.
Made a lot of money for the insurance companies, made a lot of money for the Frist family, and has left us, if we end up in the hospital, in trouble?
Absolutely. And so, a nurse today may be taking care of 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 or 15 or, you know, sometimes even more patients. There's no regulation.
What's an appropriate number?
Well, I think on a medical surgical floor, with the intensity of need that most patients have today, most nurses would say that 4 patients is really a great number.
Yeah.
And it depends on the unit. I mean, I think on an ICU, an intensive care unit, you really want 1-to-1, maximum 1-to-2, but no more than that because these people are wild.
And yet, what are our hospitals in the United States on average running at?
Well, I mean, when the California Nurses Association got into a debate about staffing regulations, that's the union in California, with the hospital industry, because they passed a bill in at the turn of the century to institute staffing regulations in California hospitals, and they needed to debate whether they what was the appropriate ratio for a medical surgical floor.
Right.
The hospital industry wanted it to be 1-10. The nurses wanted 1-4. Now, mind you, it was more than 1-10 when the hospital industry wanted 1-10.
Wow.
I mean, that's insane. You know that? I mean, it's just insane. The people today are so sick. And, you know, they're also being rammed through the hospital, assembly line through the hospital much
right.
more quickly. There's much more need to, you know.
Hey, Bill Frist needs the money, Suzanne.
Pardon?
Bill Frist needs the money.
Well, you know, in this case, I'm not going to blame it
he's got to pay his $800 million fine for defrauding the Medicare system.
Right. You know, we can't lay this on.
I understand that.
The
big insurance companies need their profits too. And
you know, look, these insurance companies and these hospitals would be quite delighted to give you all the nursing care you wanted if somebody would pay for it.
Yeah.
And
which,
you know,
which brings us around to, in the last 2 minutes here in this segment, what about single payer health care?
Well, I think we need some form of national tax funded health insurance, because if you're taking 50%, if you're wasting 50% of your money off the top for advertising, profit and market and prescription drugs and all this kind of stuff that we're spending too much on, then you're not going to have money for nursing care. And so I think we need to have some system that gets rid of these insurance companies that,
right.
you know, that pays docs on salary rather than piecework, and that liberates money for nurses and for mental health care, for elder care and so forth.
You said 50%. My understanding was that the health insurance industry, we know that Medicare operates on somewhere between a 2-3% overhead,
right.
as I recall. So
that's
so of every $100 that goes through Medicare, about $3 is the cost of administration of Medicare. The cost for every $100 that goes through private health insurance companies, I've seen numbers anywhere from 13% on the low end from the industry to 26, 28, 30% on the high end from folks like the, you know, some of the Nader groups, suggesting that because these for-profit corporations, they have to pay stockholder dividends. They have to pay multimillion dollar CEO salaries. They have to have the corporate jets. They have to have the marketing. They have to have the advertising. They have to have the multimillion dollar corporate headquarters. They have to have the golfing holidays to Maui and all that sort of stuff. So you're suggesting that the actual amount of waste that's unnecessary in there is actually 50%, not...
No, but that's in the system as a whole. We
all the different layers.
We spent almost $2 trillion on health care. It's about four
right.
times defense spending. And if you look at waste in four categories, advertising, marketing, and profit, that's what you just described, unnecessary treatment,
yeah.
high prescription drug costs, and
fraud. This is where it all adds up.
That's where it
all
adds up.
Okay, we've got to wrap it up. Suzanne Gordon, do you have a website?
Yes, SuzanneGordon.com, and the book is Nursing Against the Odds.
Nursing Against the Odds, Suzanne Gordon, SuzanneGordon.com. Thanks so much for being with us today, Suzanne. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, small dog...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I had another dream about a lion, but the door, they weren't half as frightening as they were before. But I'm thinking about eternity, some kind of ecstasy got hold on me.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones is with us from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hello, Victoria. Great to have you here. Has the Senate yet voted on whether or not John Bolton will be the wrecking ball in chief at the UN?
Not yet. That committee meeting will start sometime after 2 o'clock, and you can be sure that all eyes are on that. It's sort of the must-see TV in Washington.
Yeah.
There's a Patriot Act hearing, but no one's terribly interested in that. This is the one to go to. It looks at the moment as though the vote will go ahead, even though Senator Joe Biden, the senior Democrat on the committee, would like to delay it. Part of the feeling may be that the longer this vote is delayed, the less likely it is that he will move forward, and that they just want him to move it. They just want to move ahead.
They keep hoping he'll go away on the one hand, or on the other hand, they just want to get it over so it's no longer in the headlines.
I think they'd like to get it over so it's no longer in the headlines. Scott McClellan, White House press secretary, said today, you know, today that there was no reason for a delay in the vote and that President Bush supports him, you know, and all that kind of that can be the kiss of death, of course. But but who knows? I mean, Richard Lugar, who's the chairman of the committee, seems to indicate that yes, there are concerns, but it doesn't warrant our rejection of the president's selection.
Hasn't the former president of the big voting machine company, which is now ES&S, Chuck Hagel, hasn't he come out against John Bolton?
He came out on Sunday saying that if much more came out, then he would reconsider his vote and might go against Bolton. At that time, he was leaning towards voting for Bolton. This, even though one of his staffers is one of the people who Bolton treated very badly, allegedly, as a State Department employee, a brilliant young man, who undoubtedly, I would think, has told Senator Hagel what happened to him. And I think that's one of the reasons why Hagel is more concerned than some of the other Republicans. He has somebody on his staff who has experienced it.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a sense that, okay, they lost Bernie Kerik. They don't want to lose this guy. Five former secretaries of state have written a letter of support of his nomination. Secretary Powell was not among them.
Hmm.
Which is interesting.
That's more than interesting. That's significant.
Yes, I think it's significant. Then also the stories came out today about how Bolton apparently blocked information on more than one occasion from getting to Secretary Powell and also on one occasion from getting to Secretary Rice. Information that would basically have disagreed with his own point of view in terms of action that should be taken or strategy or tactics.
So he's his own stovepipe to his bosses.
Basically, that's what seems to be being said. And
that's amazing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, this story is to a great extent being played as abusive employees. That's not the reason that the Democrats are really wanting to hold it up. It's because he abused these employees, allegedly, because they wouldn't go along with him in terms of what intelligence meant.
So really he was abusing his employers, that being both the intelligence agencies, the State Department, the senior officials in the government, and ultimately we the people.
That's what is being alleged.
Yeah. Now, what about these 10 names that he asked for? Do you know about this?
Don't know very much about this. They want to know more about this. These are 10 names that he tried to get from, and did, I believe, from the National Security Agency, something that apparently is very unusual for somebody, for an undersecretary, to go after. When he was questioned about it by the committee, he said, yes, maybe he tried to get one or two or, you know, a couple more, but 10 is quite a lot, and they would like answers to that because it's an unusual thing.
It would be nice to know.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So any other news of the day here from Capitol Hill?
Not really. That is, I would say, that the Oklahoma City thing and the new pope is overshadowing everything. Nobody seems to have raised what I think is an interesting question, which is that President Bush and the First Lady have gone to the Abraham Lincoln Museum for its commemoration and did not go to Oklahoma and sent Cheney instead. And it struck me that maybe it could have been the other way around.
Yeah, well, Oklahoma City was Clinton's. You know, it was the terrorist act that happened on Clinton's watch, and Clinton didn't turn it into a PR stunt to get reelected like Bush did with 9/11. So maybe he's trying to distance himself. Victoria, thanks so much for being with us. Victoria
Thank
Jones
you.
From Talk Radio News Service. 29 minutes past the hour.
But, Dad...
Tyler, we've been over this 3 times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No party for you.
But the whole class is in...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that's not what we're getting, apparently, out of Tom DeLay and his supporters, the truth. 1-866, by the way, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Tom Hartman here with you. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. Toby Chaudhuri?
Toby? You got it. Toby Chaudhuri, Tom.
Chaudhuri. Thank you very much. Toby is the communication director of the Campaign for America's Future. And, Toby, your group is doing some work, or has done some homework, and is doing some proactive work with regard to Tom DeLay. Here we have Tom DeLay today having his Richard Nixon moment, his I am not a crook moment. He sends out a mailer that says, and I quote, Tom DeLay has never been found in violation of any law by anyone. Well, yeah, that's why he's not in jail yet. Yeah, but he says it would be quite easy to write an entire book about how Democrats and many in the press have chosen to selectively report and strategically ignore many facts about me and my work. And he's claiming that he has all this support, and yet George Bush won't say his name out loud. He says, you know, I'm committed to working with the majority leader in the House, but what's going on here?
Well, first of all, Tom, you know, it's crazy to think that it's going to take a conviction for things to get so bad that Republican members are going to say that this guy is just not ethically fit.
Well, that's what DeLay is saying.
Well, you know,
he's saying he's never been convicted, therefore leave him alone.
Well, it shouldn't have to smell that bad for Republican members to choose a side here.
Yeah.
And I think it's really going to come down to Republican members and whether they stand for DeLay or whether they stand for decency.
And you're doing something to help find that out.
We are indeed. We just did a new survey. We had constituents in their districts call their representatives in Congress. About 1,000 constituents responded, and it looks like only 20 reps so far publicly stand with Tom DeLay.
20 members of Congress?
That's it so far.
Out of, what, is it 235 total?
435.
I mean, 435. Yeah, excuse me. I'm brain dead here today. 435. 20.
Only 20 so far. So let's see what happens.
That's less than 5%, right?
Yeah,
It's
less than 5%, and it gets even worse than that because, you know, Tom DeLay is saying that this is all part of a vast left-wing conspiracy, which we all wish we had. What's more so
in our dreams, right? In our dreams.
Exactly. You know, but you know, it's conservative lawmakers who are coming out and, you know, raising some doubt about him. Rick Santorum, Lincoln Chafee, even Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich have said that this guy is just not fit to lead.
So what is your group doing about this?
So we're
this being the Campaign for America's Future. And by the way, before you tell us that, what's the website for the Campaign for America's Future?
www.ourfuture.org.
Okay, so what is ourfuture.org, the Campaign for America's Future, doing about this?
What we're doing is we're basically shining a light into the darkness here. We want everyone to know what's going on with Tom DeLay, and we want everyone to know that his abuse of power has created probably the most corrupt Congress in recent history. And, you know, I was just listening to the news report about what's happened with this bankruptcy bill, and this is a great example of the corruption we're seeing in Congress today.
Yeah.
You know, there's this corporate feeding frenzy that's making us pay more at the pump, pay more at the pharmacy, and this is exactly the kind of corruption that Tom DeLay has brought.
It's a stick it to the middle class, make sure that the millionaires and billionaires are well provided for because they're needed as campaign donors, and make sure that the corporations, the large multinational corporations, are well provided for, and on, you know, onward through the fog, right? I mean, that's exactly right.
And I think Newt Gingrich actually put it best. You know, he said Tom DeLay's problem isn't with the Democrats. His problem is with the American people. And it's the American people who are getting the short end of the stick, and it's time for us all to raise our voices and to say we're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And if we're it's time for all of us, you're suggesting, to have a what do you call it? A Howard Beale moment?
You gotta say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
There you go.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm
mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Are you with me, Toby?
I couldn't have said it better myself.
There you go. Thanks to Howard Beale there. Oh my. So what do you expect to come out of what you're doing? I mean, so you're shining a light. That's kind of broad. Specifically, how are you doing that? Just by publicizing this? But.
Sure. We ran TV ads in Tom DeLay's district.
And whoa! In Sugar Land?
In the Houston area, including Sugar Land. Yes, indeed. We ran it for a week. An ad that showed that. Tom DeLay can't wash his hands of corruption, but Congress sure can wash its hands of Tom DeLay. And as a result of that, we saw the polling numbers in his district go down.
You know, this is what the Republicans did to how quickly they forget. The former Senate Majority Leader.
To Tom Daschle.
Tom Daschle, thank you. I knew it was a Tom and a D. Yeah, and it worked. You think you'll have as much success?
Well, I think, you know, we're just speaking the truth, and it's certainly, you know, forced him to respond to all the support he's losing in his district with this, you know, this talking points memo that he's put out.
Now, Tom DeLay is famous for getting revenge and going after his enemies and really and truly harming them. Are you concerned about this? Is your organization on, you know, getting IRS audits or whatever? I mean, the FBI? Are you sneaking peeks? Are you waking up in the morning and whatever? I mean, is any of this kind of stuff going on, Toby?
Well, I know that they've hurled a bunch of attacks at us. Most of them are baseless, and we know that they're not going to help his defense from these corruption charges.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's just keep getting the word out. And people can learn more about this by going to ourfuture.org. Toby Chaudhary, Communications Director of the Campaign for America's Future. Toby, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you very much. Stay in sight.
I'll do it. And keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Toby. It's 20 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartmann radio program, and yet this Tom DeLay, I am not a crook. This is this is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And in the meantime, here we have Molly Ivins. Did you maybe you caught this? I'm not sure. She's quoting this week, her column this last weekend, quoting from David K. Johnson. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He also won a Pulitzer Prize for writing about taxes, notes Molly Ivins. He wrote a book called Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. And she quotes him in her column. So this is actually, I'm quoting Molly Ivins, quoting David K. Johnson. People making $60,000 paid a larger share of their 2001 income in federal income, Social Security, and Medicare taxes than a family making $25 million. You get this? Now, this was before Bush got in there and started monkeying with the tax code to make it even more favorable for families making $25 million a year. And in the income tax alone, people making $400,000 paid a larger share of their income than the 7,000 households who made $10 million or more. This is where the statistics are getting really interesting. There are only 7,000 households in the United States with an income of more than $10 million. CEOs, media barons, and what? I mean, how many 7,000 people out of a nation of 300 million, more or less, 7,000 people making more than $10 million a year. And yet our entire tax code has now been skewed toward these people. Under Eisenhower, people in that tax bracket were paying 90% income taxes. Now, that didn't kick in until it was up to the equivalent of about 8 or 10 million of today's dollars. You know, they paid 30%, 40%, 50%. It was graduated. And then after $10 million, they started paying 90%. And some of them were still accumulating it. But there was not that incentive to just accumulate and build not just a personal fortune, but a personal empire. And now we have this, you know, this empire building and this radical change in our tax code. And for this, as Molly Ivins notes, we can thank the Republican Party. As Johnson notes, one 1985 law promoted in the Senate as relieving middle-class Americans. This is something, you know, middle-class Americans, yes, they really needed tax relief in 1985. So the president passed this law, gave a huge tax break to corporate executives who make personal use of company jets. Now, let's see, 85 wasn't... Reagan was president then. Yeah, so, well, it makes perfect sense. CEOs may now fly, Molly Ivins notes, so CEOs may fly, or this is David K. Johnson, actually, CEOs may now fly to vacations or Saturday golf outings in luxury for a penny a mile. Congress shifted the real cost of about $6 per mile to shareholders who pay two-thirds and to taxpayers. Since 1988... he notes, Congress has also cut in half the IRS's capacity to enforce tax laws, replacing it with an extra effort to reduce audits of corporations and the rich. And last year, the IRS announced that they are going to increase audits on people making less than $50,000 a year. So, wonderful times, right, for the American middle class. The Senate budget currently under consideration includes $129 billion in new tax breaks for millionaires. That's $129 billion. And about $3 billion cut in farm and nutrition programs, that is also known as food stamps. So I guess we know where their priorities are. $129 billion cut in the taxes these 7,000 families make or pay. A $2.8 billion cut in the taxes only 7,000 families pay, and a $2.8 billion cut in the food stamp program. The House has already passed a budget that cuts at least $15 billion for Medicaid and $5.3 billion from food stamps. Molly Ivins notes in 2002, at least 25.5 million people went to soup kitchens and food pantries. In 2003, 1.1 million more joined the lines. Wages for the average worker fell after adjusting for inflation, the first such drop in 10 years. And she wraps her column up just brilliantly, quoting John Kenneth Galbraith. The modern conservative, this, and I corresponded with him a few years ago, his remarkable man, John Kenneth Galbraith. The modern conservative, he says, is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. For selfishness. What, you know, need you more? It's, but just in health notes, by the way, a couple of little things that I wanted to share with you. One of them, I think, is here in Scientific American. Interesting article today. Did you know that happy people tend to be healthier longer? A fascinating study. Seriously. No, seriously, this is a fascinating study. It says that people who are happy live longer. They handle stress better. This all has to do with stress response, with the ability to respond to stress, the ability to deal with it. Happy people live longer. And now also they are discovering, and I've been looking for this. Oh, here it is. I know, it's on the back of my delay story. They're also discovering, speaking of health, that Advil, Motrin, Aleve, these NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, all of them with the exception of aspirin, and apparently acetaminophen or Tylenol, with the exception of aspirin and Tylenol, they did a study in Norway with smokers, and they were originally looking for mouth cancer. This is, you know, a study trying to find out, are smokers more likely to get oral cancer? Mouth cancer is pretty terrible cancer. I when I was younger, I knew an older fellow who died of it, and it basically ate away his face. It was awful, painful, difficult, and it killed him. And he was a smoker. And so they looked at smokers in Norway who were taking these non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And the theory was that cancer has at its core inflammation, that if there's inflammation in the system, that will lead to cancer. This is how some viruses cause cancer. For example, human papillomavirus and cervical cancer. It's one of the theories about how it works, that it's inflammation. The chronic inflammation will lead to cancer. It leads to disruption of DNA and cancer. And so if you give people anti-inflammatories, does it reduce their risk of cancer? And it turns out in the study in Norway that, in fact, it did. That the people who would have developed oral cancer, they cut the oral cancer rate about in half in Norway in this study. It was a relatively small study, 908 people, but it cut in half the risk of preventing oral cancer, but it so increased the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease that it more than offset the risk of cutting the cancer. And they weren't expecting that. They just discovered just as many people, or perhaps even more people, were dying among the group who were taking the ibuprofen as among the group of people who were not It's just that they were dying of something different. They were dying of heart disease instead of mouth cancer. In fact, they note risk was highest, this in this article by Marilyn Marchioni in the Associated Press, risk was highest among ibuprofen users who were nearly three times more likely to die of cardiovascular disease than non-NSAID users. Aspirin was the only NSAID that did not seem to raise the risk, but the numbers of aspirin users in the study were relatively small. So just when you thought it was safe, I'll tell you, as far as I know, the only drugs that don't produce these kinds of side effects are the opiates. But nobody's advocating that because then you've got addiction as a side effect. So what do? Well, you try to stay out of pain, I guess, or buck up. This is tough news today. Or you could be happy and you're less likely to die. Don't worry, be happy. It's possible. It's possible. Be an optimist. Make your glass half full. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we're back, and our bumper music didn't fire off. Welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Tony in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How's Oregon?
Oh, it's beautiful, actually. It's a beautiful place. Vermont was a beautiful place too. I have to say, and I love Michigan as well. I grew up there, so it's.
Me and my fiance are going to vacation in Vermont this summer. So
yeah, you'll like it. You'll like it. So what's up?
First, I'd like to say that I think it is a good news day. Any day that you hear that we might get rid of time delay is a good day.
Yeah.
And over your break, Rush Limbaugh was saying how he doesn't use talking points in his show. I might like to know that. And I bet later today, Sean Hannity will be saying how he doesn't use talking points on his show. Michael Savage saying he doesn't use talking points on his show.
The talking point of the day. Well, see, that's essentially Tom DeLay's talking point. He's saying that it's really quite remarkable. He falsely claims in his memo that he does not stand accused of any violation. He himself admitted violating House rules. In December, he acknowledged accepting contributions for his legal defense fund from lobbyists. And he's sending out this letter going, I don't do this.
I can't wait till he's gone.
Yeah, well, we may have to wait a long time. But it's going to be interesting to see. You know, if Toby is right, his group is pulling it together, and they're going to make something happen. I hope so.
I hope so, too.
Yeah. So that was it, Tony?
Yep, that was it.
Okay, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, 3 minutes before the top of the hour. Hey, the abuse wish list. Have you heard about this? This is a little scary. And speaking of a little scary, in the next hour I want to get into, today is the 10th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing and the 12th anniversary of Waco. And no coincidence there between the two, by the way. But we'll get into that in the next hour. Investigative documents released yesterday reveal Army intelligence officials, I'm quoting, Army intelligence officials in Iraq developed and circulated wish lists of harsh interrogation techniques they hoped to use on detainees in August of 2003, including tactics such as low-voltage electrocution, using dogs, using snakes. You're really going to get great intelligence this way. You know, you really are. This is. I'm being facetious. I hope you realize. I am absolutely. This is not the way that you get decent intelligence. If you want to get decent intelligence out of people, you want to induce the Stockholm syndrome in them. It's the same thing that the FBI did after Tim McVeigh bombed the McMurrah building, the federal building in Oklahoma. They went to the right wing paramilitary groups and they said, you know, help us out here. This guy is nuts. And these groups who had been philosophically aligned with McVeigh before the bombing saw the horror, and they said, you know, you're right. We'll help you out. Anyhow, sometimes you wonder, you know, what happens when the person at the top is so weird? Well, now we're finding out. It's a tragedy for America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
there be hope.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Viagra for your brain, where being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman radio program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to hear from Brad Blog founder, Brad. I'll get his name for you in a minute. Actually, I'll get it for you at the bottom of the hour. Friedman, there you go, Brad Friedman. And he's going to be talking about, well, actually, we'll find out at the bottom of the hour. The Democrats.com has this really cool thing where every week they pick, like, the blogger of the week, and they get them on. And they do a phone, it's an invitation-only phone call, conference call. It's limited to 100 people. And it's like the nation's top bloggers and people who write for political magazines and online publications and whatnot. And they had invited me to participate in this, but I'm on the air when they're doing it. They do it from 1 to 2 o'clock Eastern time every Tuesday. So, and they pick a blogger every week. And so this week, the blogger is Brad Friedman. And of bradblog.com. And so I called him up last night, and after I got the email that Democrats.com sends around to all the participants and saw what the topic was going to be and everything, I said, this is going to be really cool. How about coming on the program and sharing with all of our listeners what you just shared with the nation's top blogger? So we will get to that at the bottom of the hour. I do want to talk about the never-ending war against terrorism, the crime of the century. But first, Amy in San Diego's on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just want to ask you a quick question. Jim Hightower, in between, you know, when you have your breaks, he's been talking about the bankruptcy bill and how the rich can shelter their money and I think their trusts or
asset
something.
Protection
yes.
Trusts.
Okay, how come everyone can't use it? How come you have to be rich?
Well, there are only certain types of assets that can go into asset protection trusts.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so you would have to have relatively enormous amounts of them, and it costs a lot of money to set these things up. I mean, it's going to cost you $100,000-$200,000 to set up a trust, and it has to be, you know, and I don't know all the details because I'm not a person who would qualify, so I've never looked into the details of it, other than knowing that it's the sort of thing that if you have assets that are under $3 or $4 million, it's like, why bother? It's more expensive than it's worth. If you have assets worth $30 million, $50 million, $100 million, $300 million, if you're one of those 7,000 families that makes more than $10 million a year in the United States, then it starts to make sense.
Oh, well, I'm so glad they helped them out. I'm so worried about those 7,000 people.
those folks are the folks who, welcome to the oligarchy in America. Those folks are the folks who grease the wheels of the American Congress and certainly of American commerce. And it's a tragedy that it is, frankly.
It really is.
And there have been times in this country when it's been more that the case and times when it was less that the case. You know, when Roosevelt was president, for example.
Yeah.
And really, I'd say all the way up to Reagan. All the way up to Reagan. Reagan was the guy who really took this thing all apart.
Yes.
And that's why the conservatives all consider him like he walked on water. You know, he turned fishes into loaves he fed the multitudes, he fed the 5,000. Actually, he fed the 7,000.
Yes,
that's the 7,000
right.
families who make more than $10 million a year.
Oh, well, I'm so glad they're safe.
they have nothing to worry about. The Kenny Lays of the world, the Jack Welches of the world, the Dick Cheneys of the world. You know, Dick Cheney's compensation.
Oh, yeah.
His last year at Halliburton, he made $30 million, plus he got a $20 million severance package, plus this last year, 2004, he just filed his tax returns, he made $3,000 less from Enron than he made as being vice president of the United States.
I know, it's ridiculous, and they always say, oh, you know what, he wasn't the vice president when he was, you know, in charge of Enron. They're paying him for, you know,
Halliburton.
Halliburton, right. So they're saying they're make
it's deferred compensation.
Exactly. They want us to think that we're stupid enough to believe that if he's getting money, still getting money from them, he's not helping them.
Right, or he doesn't care about them.
Yeah. Right.
It's
exactly.
This is really an arm's length transaction. Yes, I'm only getting $180,000 an hour. Yeah, give me a break.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Yeah, Amy, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Thanks for listening and spreading the good word. The never-ending crime of the century, the war against terrorism. This is a story that, in my opinion, really and truly needs to be discussed. This is a conversation we need to be having in America. And it's a conversation that the press has not been having. The press really has not allowed us to have. And a conversation that the cons have not allowed us to have. And that is, how do you respond to a terrorist incident? Whether it's a small one or a large one. How do you respond to a terrorist incident? Now, the easy answer, or let me say the straightforward answer, easy, straightforward, whatever. You could just boil it down. If the terrorist incident was perpetrated by a state, like Japan bombing Pearl Harbor, if the terrorist incident was perpetrated by a state, then it's an act of war. It is, in effect, a declaration of the war. And the UN would agree with that, and international bodies agree. Everybody pretty much agrees with that. It's an act of war. You go to war against that state. However, if it's done by a private group, by a group that is not sponsored by a state, that is independent of a state, that is not a state, done by a private group, how do you respond to it? Well, historically, I'm talking about like for thousands of years, the way that civilized nations have responded to acts of terrorism by non-state, what are referred to as non-state actors. It has nothing to do with performance, but by non-state actors, is they have treated them as criminals. The IRA comes into London and sets off a bomb in a trash container that kills a bunch of civilians in Piccadilly Square or something. The British don't say, we're going to declare war on Northern Ireland, because that's where the IRA is hanging out. No. They say, these guys are criminals. We're going to use the powers of the police to track them down. Now, if those criminals in their own neighborhoods are creating problems that the police can't handle, then they bring the army in to restore order. But the army wasn't an offensive weapon against them. In the case of the British and the IRA, the army was always a defensive, or at least represented as a defensive weapon. The same with the November 17 terrorist group in Greece. The same with the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. The same with the Red Brigades in Italy. I mean, they actually captured. Here you've got a terrorist group that captured the prime minister of the country, Aldo Moro. This would be as if terrorists in the United States had taken our president hostage. This is what happened in Italy. They took Aldo Moro hostage, stuffed him in the trunk of a car, and he died there. They killed him. Did the country declare war on them? No. They said, these guys are criminals. And everybody in Italy said, yes, they are. And they brought to justice several hundred people, and many of them, the majority of them, were turned in by friends and family and neighbors because everybody was, these guys are nuts. Yes, we believe in social justice, which they claim to be all in favor of, but we're not in favor of killing, kidnapping and killing prime ministers or presidents or anything else like this. And because Germany responded to the Bader-Meinhof gang the way they did, and because Greece responded November 17 the way they did, and because Spain responded to ETA the way they did, and because England responded to the IRA the way they did, and because Italy responded to the Red Brigades the way they did, the consequence of that response in every single one of those cases in all of those different countries, the consequence of that response has been that terrorism is reduced over time. Well, here we have now in the United States terrorism going up. We went from 123 terror incidents in 2003 to 625 terrorism incidents worldwide. And so what does Condoleezza Rice, how does she respond to that as Secretary of State? What's the Bush administration's response? Let's not tell the people. Let's just keep it a secret. We don't need to tell people about this. Well, this gets back to that original question that I asked. How do you respond to an act of terrorism? And today's anniversary, and this, I think, is one of the reasons why George W. Bush is not in Oklahoma today. Today's anniversary is the anniversary of the appropriate and correct way to respond to terrorism. Bill Clinton did it. There was a terrorist act by Tim McVeigh in Oklahoma City. He thought he was going to bring on the rapture. He thought he was going to bring the end times. He was going to make a perfect America. Everything was going to work out. It was going to be just great. All he had to do was blow up the federal building, and all the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in America would rise up and kill off the people of color and kill off the people of other religions and take over the government, and Jesus would return to earth, and everything would be great. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. This literally, Tim McVeigh read the Turner Diaries, which is a novel in which that's the storyline, and it starts out with the bombing of a federal building in Oklahoma, the Turner Diaries. And this was his Bible. He was acting it out. Which makes you gives you a little kind of spooky feeling when you get that NBC, one of the world's largest defense contractors, owned by GE, one of the world's largest defense contractors, is going to be airing a TV series about the end times and all the wonders thereof. But, you know, that, I digress. So here we have Tim McVeigh reading the Turner Diaries, an apocalyptic novel that opens with a convenience store robbery and ends with an Armageddon-style worldwide holocaust, leaving only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants standing. The government of the United States, in the novel, responds to this terrorist attack, the bombing of the federal building, by cracking down on dissent, expanding the power in the book Tim McVeigh read. The government responded to the bombing of the federal building by cracking down on dissent, expanding the power of the executive branch, and shredding constitutional civil rights protections. And the people of America were so horrified in the novel that they rose up against the government and overthrew it. And the true patriots, in Tim McVeigh's mind, because he really thought he was, insane as he was, the true patriots took over. And he expected that after the bombing of the federal building, people would rise up. You know what happened instead? All the militia groups around the United States, and there are many of them, every state has them, the Posse Comitatus groups and the militia groups and whatnot, all of these groups around the United States, they all said, whoa, this guy's nuts. Just like Muslims all over the world said the same thing after Osama bin Laden perpetrated 9/11, assuming that he did. I mean, the perception, at least around the world, is that he did. He's taking credit for it. And the Islamic groups on 9/12, 9/13, 9/15, you know, in the weeks after, they were saying, whoa. And the FBI here in the United States went to these right-wing patriot groups and they said, hey, help us get Tim. And by and large, they got a lot of cooperation. They didn't have to do rubber hoses. They didn't need electric shocks. They didn't need to go to extreme rendition. They simply said, hey, help us out, guys. This guy's nuts. We could have done the same thing. But Bush, no. Bush had to have a war, because no wartime president has ever not been reelected. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And a hard place. Yes, indeed. Stuck between a rock. IRAQ. And a hard place. That's where we find ourselves. And why? Because George W. Bush decided to respond differently to an act of terror than did Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton said, we have been struck by a criminal. We have been struck by somebody who's mentally ill. We have been struck by somebody who's unbalanced. We have been struck by somebody who's out of their mind. We don't need to strike back. We need to catch them. Bill Clinton was not a revenge kind of guy. He was a justice kind of guy. You get this? And we had the Islamic world right there with us. They were having demonstrations in downtown Tehran, Iran, on the day after 9/11, candlelight vigils on behalf of the United States, on behalf of us, in sympathy with us. And had George W. Bush responded to 9/11 the same way that Bill Clinton responded to Oklahoma City, those people in Iran would still be with us. And we wouldn't be sitting around worrying about whether or not they're making nuclear weapons. We might well have had a rapprochement with them that would have allowed us to we might be doing trade with them. This is how you corrupt governments with democracy. Is you make it available to them. It's what we've done with the former Soviet states. It's what we did with the USSR. To some extent, it's happening in China. Time will tell, because I am convinced that the Chinese are corrupt. They've got their own little agenda, shall we say. But in any case, this is how you do it. Bill Clinton had it right. He did, and that's why George W. Bush will not show up in Oklahoma City today. That's why he will not go there. That's why he sent Dick Cheney there. Because it would highlight the very stark difference between the way Bill Clinton responded to terrorism, which closed it out, gave closure to the victims, gave closure to America, let us breathe a sigh of relief, kept our civil rights intact, and didn't exploit it for political gain. And the way George W. Bush responded to an act of terrorism of inventing a whole new category of persons, enemy combatants. No, they're not prisoners of war, not entitled to Geneva protections, and they're not criminals. They're not entitled to civil protections. They are enemy combatants, a word literally that was made up by Alberto Gonzalez and George W. Bush. Literally made up out of whole cloth. There is no precedent for it. There is no status at law for it. Constructed 6 concentration camps in Cuba. 6. We just built the 6th. And started taking apart the U.S. Constitution. George W. Bush responded to a terrorist attack the way Tim McVeigh believed Bill Clinton would. McVeigh was wrong. Clinton respected the Constitution. But Bush has not. And look at what it has done to us. We have acts of terrorism now 300% more in 2004 than in 2003. A continuous increase in acts of terrorism. And Bush, of course, will say, oh, look, there's more terrorists, or they're nastier terrorists, or whatever. The Arabs were saying it. Mubarak of Egypt was saying it. Hussein of Jordan was saying it. All of these guys, they were saying, don't do it. Don't bomb Iraq. Saddam will fall on his own. There are so many ways you can take a dictator out without killing 100,000 innocent civilians. Or somewhere, let's say, to be absolutely clear and accurate, somewhere between the 15,000 to 25,000 that are quite well documented, dead innocent civilians in Iraq, and the 100,000 that the British journal Lancet published as the number based on epidemiological studies, based on looking at, you know, what might have happened where to whom. Had Bush just had the common sense that Bill Clinton had, the world would be such a different place right now. Just the common sense. Where's the common sense, George? A little common sense. No, he's got to twist it around and use it for an election campaign. It's just wrong. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
And now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I want to love y'all.
Forgiving people dying, children hurt and even crying. When you practice what you preach, would you turn the other cheek? Father,
and welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And as I was mentioning earlier in the program, Democrats.com does this weekly blog call for the top bloggers and reporters and whatnot in the country, and they get about 100 people together, I think is the limit. And every week they have a top blogger on, and the top blogger this week was Brad Friedman. It's Friedman, right?
Friedman, yes.
Friedman. Hey, Brad. I don't have my paper in front of me. Sorry. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, right?
That's it.
Yeah, okay. And you've broken some interesting stuff, this Clint Curtis stuff and Tom Feeney and all these things. And so you were sharing your insights and your wisdom with the folks of the blogosphere today. What was on your mind?
Actually, today's story is not on the Clint Curtis and the Tom Feeney mess. It's on a story that I recently broke, about 2 weeks ago now. The emergence of this group calling themselves the American Center for Voting Rights.
Ah, yes, who are now trying to infiltrate the Carter-Baker Commission.
Oh, they're not trying to infiltrate. They have already infiltrated. They, in fact, are responsible in a sense for the creation of this commission, and the folks who have been secretly seated on this commission, they work very closely with James Baker.
Let's back up just a little bit, Brad Friedman with bradblog.com, and tell our listeners what the commission is, who's on it, and how and why it came into being,
so people know
what we're talking about.
Yeah, to do that, let me back up just a step or two to this American Center for Voting Rights.
Okay.
They emerged on March 17th on the Internet for the first time, and we like to say Talon News-like.
March 17th of this year. You're talking a month ago.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
A month ago, they appeared. 3 days later, they were testifying before a U.S. House Administrative Committee on election problems in Ohio. They were the only such voting rights group to testify at this congressional hearing. And
you're talking about the Conyers Commission?
No, unfortunately, I'm talking about the Bob Ney House Administrative Committee hearing.
Republican-run hearing.
Republican-run hearing, correct. And this ACBR...
Oh, my. The fix is in, Brad.
Oh, boy. Just you wait. Guess who comprises this American Center for Voting Rights? The fellow who did the speaking at the hearings, the congressional hearings, was a man by the name of Mark F. Thor Hearn. Thor Hearn happens to be the lead national counsel for Bush Cheney 04 Inc.
Whoa! And nobody noticed this.
Nobody noticed it because he didn't happen to mention that when he testified before Congress. Furthermore, and it gets worse, I'm sorry to say, this is a group, by the way, they're a nonpartisan 501c3 tax-exempt group, or so they say. We have not yet been able to find their 501c3 papers, but that's what they claim to be, nonpartisan, and there are specific rules about that 501c3 thing that you have to be nonpartisan. So, in fact, it's comprised of Thor Hearn. And the spokesman for the group, the press spokesman, is a fellow by the name of Jim Dyke. Jim Dyke's other job is the communications director for the Republican National Committee.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
And these are the guys who started the group that is now... Well, tell us how they've infiltrated the Carter-Baker Commission.
Well, yeah, we're still connecting a few dots here, but we know obviously that they're connected to Bush Cheney, to the RNC, and in fact to Jim Baker and his law firm, his Dallas, Texas law firm, or Houston law firm, Baker Botts. Now, what happened was 3 days later on March 24th at 2 p.m.,
this is 3 days after they launched their website.
After they launched, after they had their hearings, after they testified.
I see.
And
a few days after they launched their website.
Correct. And by the way, when they testified on what went wrong in Ohio in the November elections, apparently what went wrong was there were a number of, according to the ACVR, there were a number of liberal, Democratic-related groups, the ACT, ACORN, NAACP, who apparently were, there was a voter registration fraud problem according to them, and that they were signing up people with the name of Dick Tracy, Mary Poppins, etc. Now, never mind that there is not a single instance of Dick Tracy or Mary Poppins actually voting in Ohio.
Right.
But that was the big problem. That's what went wrong in Ohio. Never mind the thousands of folks who were disenfranchised, who had to wait in line for 10 hours, the thousands of votes that showed up from nowhere and, you know, disappeared in other places, documented evidence of all of these things that went wrong. No, the problem was, you know, a few instances where somebody named Mary Poppins was apparently signed up, never voted. So it's a big smokescreen report. Now, 3 days later, after they testified with this big smokescreen, on March 24th at 2 p.m., a press release came out on the U.S. Newswire stating that the Baker-Carter Commission had been convened, a blue-ribbon commission to look at election reform and to make recommendations for the future. 24 minutes later, the ACVR released their own press release.
The ACVR is the acronym for this group. The American Center. Give me their name again.
Yeah, American Center for voting rights.
For voting rights. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds very very noble. Sort of like the Women's League of Women's Voters or something. It's,
yes. Okay. Yes. They're very concerned about voting rights.
Yes. especially if you're a Republican.
Right. And well, as a matter of fact, Thor Hearn said to the Congressional Committee that he was a longtime voting rights advocate, and that's what he was
as the head lawyer for the RNC,
right,
or for the Bush-Cheney
it almost blows your mind. I mean,
the audacity of it blows my mind.
Yep, and you know, on a personal level, it offends the heck out of me because we're at the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act that was, you know, instituted after folks were murdered in this country fighting for voting rights in,
right,
you know, in Selma and the march from Selma to Montgomery. And for these, pardon me, jerks to come out and say they're voting rights advocates when people have died in this country over the past century and, in fact, are...
The past three centuries.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put this in the broader context.
You're absolutely right. And
in
now,
fact, it was Tom Paine who said that the vote is the beating heart of democracy.
You're absolutely right. And now those folks, we've got thousands of men and women around the world who are ostensibly fighting for democracy and voting rights in other countries, and the system back here is being completely gamed. So
you were getting up to what these guys are up to now with the Carter Baker Commission.
Right. 24 minutes later, after the commission was announced, lo and behold, the ACVR had their press release out on the very same news release service, U.S. Newswire, lauding the creation of this commission, pointing to how wonderful Jimmy Carter is, and James Baker will also be the co-chair. Don't notice. Nobody else
don't
knew.
Look at that man behind the screen.
Exactly. Yes. These aren't the droids you're looking for.
Right. That's right. These aren't the you're looking for. The, yes.
Exactly. Yep. And nobody else. Now, mind you, I'm the co-founder at VelvetRevolution.us, which is a group comprised of over 100 now true voting rights and election reform organizations. None of us, nobody, knew anything about the convening of this commission, the real voting rights groups. We knew nothing about it. Even if we had heard about it at 2 p.m. as soon as that press release hit, I think we all would have been hard-pressed to get a press release out either for it or against it 24 minutes later.
Yeah.
So clearly, the fix is in. These guys knew about the commission beforehand, and what do you know? Lo and behold, Thor Hearn is in fact on the academic advisory panel for this commission, along with Jim Baker, the most inappropriate man possible to lead such a commission, and his cronies from his law firm Baker Botts are all on the commission, are all witnesses. As well as voting machine company representatives are actually sitting on this commission.
What? Which voting machine companies?
Ralph Munro, who is on the chairman of the board for Vote Here, is sitting on the commission.
Vote Here, is that the one that has all the ex-CIA guys on its board of directors? I can't keep the players straight any longer.
Me neither.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, RawStory.com did an expose on picking up sort of where I left off with my ACVR reporting and the Baker Carter Commission, and she put together Larissa Alexandrovna, the reporter
right.
there, put
She's
together.
She's great.
Yeah, she is. She put together a map, a matrix, if you will, of how all of these groups are interconnected, how the ACVR is connected to the Swift Boats for Truth, to the Baker Carter Commission, you know, to the folks who were putting purple heart band-aids, you know.
Oh, and it gets worse than that. I got to, you know, John Corsi of the, or Corsi or whatever, from the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, the guy who wrote
yeah.
the book.
Right.
We got solicited to have him on our program, and we may actually have him on the program in the next day or two. He's going to tell our listeners that it is vital that we prepare to bomb Iran right away.
Oh, what a surprise.
He's trying to run advertisements on TV showing the U.S. bombing Iran, and the networks are refusing to run his ads, and he's all upset about it, and so he's going to the media to get the message out, right?
Well, and who knew that Swift Boat veterans would be such experts in all foreign policy?
it's just remarkable. And not only that, they're experts on domestic policy because the same people
yeah.
are running the campaign against the
Social Security.
Yeah, I keep wanting to say NAACP. What is the National Association of Retired Persons?
Yeah.
Incredible. Anyway, so you were saying.
Apparently everyone on those Swift Boats was very smart. Except for John Kerry, apparently he was
the only uninformed one in the bunch.
Correct.
Yeah.
So we're
yeah.
lucky that the rest of them are so clever. Actually, I'm not sure what I was saying. I got lost here.
Well, you were talking about the various representatives of the voting machine companies who are on the commission.
Right.
And who are advisors to the commission.
Yeah, advisors. Well, in the case of Ralph Monroe, he's actually a commissioner on this commission, along with fellows like Robert Mosbacher, who is heads an energy company, which is represented by James Baker's law firm. I mean, this is James Baker, the guy ensuring that votes would not be counted in 2000.
Right. He's the guy who ran the operation in Florida to steal the election from Al Gore.
Right. I mean, and basically, you know, he went to the Supreme Court demanding that America's votes were not counted. Now you have this commission.
And he won, by the way.
Yes, he did.
I mean, he got a ruling out of the Supreme Court saying there is no right, the American people have no right to vote for President of the United States. That's entirely up to the states.
It blows your mind. And now he is co-chair of a commission which, as Jimmy Carter said, one of their mandates would be to make recommendations on how to improve inclusion in the electoral process.
Right.
So can you think of anybody better to lead up that?
Well, here's the question in my mind, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. Brad, the question in my mind is, when is Jimmy Carter going to figure out that he's been had and go public with it?
You know, I don't know. We are doing everything we can to get through to him. We've set up an email campaign at velvetrevolution.us. Your listeners can stop on by there and send an email to Jimmy Carter and say, hey, you know, Mr. President, what are you doing here? And, you know, please get James Baker off this commission and his other cronies off this commission. So I would urge everyone to stop by. And, you know, frankly, bury these guys with email, letting them know that the American people do not, you know, trust James Baker to lead an election reform commission. Now, John Conyers' office, I've been in touch with them. They are furious about this. They are furious about the way the hearings went yesterday. I don't know if you were able to cover them at all, but
I did not catch them. We have been just up to our eyeballs here and
yeah,
moving
well,
and stuff. You know, the moving vans and it's just excuse, but
no. Well, so. Listen. I mean, look, this commission came out of nowhere on everybody. And
so bring us up to speed. What happened yesterday? We've got about 2.5 minutes here left.
Okay. What happened yesterday is that three-quarters at least of the meeting was devoted to how we can improve the election system by requiring photo IDs when people vote, because apparently there is an epidemic of voter registration fraud and voter fraud. I had no idea. I've been studying this since the early hours of November 3rd. I didn't realize the problem was with voter fraud.
Nothing wrong with the machines, though.
No.
Nothing wrong with the machines. The software's fine. The hardware's fine. It's all
right. Yeah. They have essentially what they're in the process of doing is morphing the election irregularities and the election fraud into voter fraud. Right. And that's what how they're going to make recommendations to correct what went on in 2004. By instituting these Jim Crow era laws, you know, 10% of voters don't have photo ID. And it's usually in minority districts where, you know,
or
people
poor
live
districts,
in,
right.
Yeah. Poor districts where they live in cities, where they don't have driver license, et cetera. Those folks,
or the elderly.
Or the elderly,
right.
Exactly.
Where they can't get in to renew a driver's license or something like that.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Now, John Fund, yeah, do you know John Fund?
John Fund, the writer for the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal.
Correct. He testified yesterday before the commission.
Oh, my.
Yep, and told them that to stop provisional voter fraud, I didn't know there was an epidemic of that either, folks should be forced to cast their provisional ballots in their own precinct. If not, they should be thrown away. And the
why don't we just bring back literacy tests?
Oh, you know what?
And poll taxes.
He actually said in the hearings that the reason that they should have to vote in their own precinct for provisionals is so that the poll workers would recognize if they belonged in the neighborhood or not.
Oh, my. Oh
yes,
my.
Sir.
Well, people can learn more about this, Brad Friedman, the great work that you're doing at bradblog.com and velvetrevolution.us, right?
Thank you, Tom. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and Brad, thanks so much for being with us and sharing with us your insights and all the hard work you've been doing. I know you've been on this thing like a pit bull on the pant leg. What was it, George W. Bush? A pit bull on the pant leg of opportunity. And I salute you. Well done. Thanks so much.
Sir.
Thank you so much for being on today. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour, Truth in Broadcasting. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. With the continuing erosion of the middle class and the separation...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Power gone, long time hassling. Where has all the power gone? Make mine to go.
Yeah, just talk to Tom DeLay about that.
Ask the U.S. everyone, what will they ever earn? What will they ever earn?
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Oh, we had a caller there, and he vanished. Okay. So the experts who follow the extreme radical right, Now, this is really fascinating. This is a follow-up on the 10th anniversary today of the Oklahoma City bombing and the 12th anniversary of the Waco meltdown, which was, by the way, a lot of people are sitting around blaming Clinton and Reno for this, and I agree that they deserve their share of blame. But let's remember that the stalking, as it were, the FBI stalking of Koresh and company, regardless of their crimes, I mean, there's an appropriate way to bring people to justice. The FBI stalking of Koresh and company started under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. And Clinton inherited that. But in any case, and as many folks on the extreme right know, experts who follow the extreme radical right have some interesting observations about the consequences, about what has come out of the last 4 years of the Bush administration, the Bush response to terror versus the Clinton response to terror. And Steve Johnson did a great piece on this. He's a reporter for MSNBC on MSNBC.com today. And he says, although it's been 10 years since the Oklahoma City bombing and no similar attacks have occurred on U.S. soil, experts who follow the extreme radical right say they still pose a serious threat of domestic terrorism. He knows hate groups seem to be thriving. He goes on to add, those who follow the violent right-wing movement in the United States break it down into two broad groups. There's the anti-government patriot movement, with which Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh was associated, and, on the other hand, hate groups such as the neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. Although, he points out, sometimes these groups overlap. The Patriot Movement folks are the folks who are really, their main thing is, you know, the UN, it's one world government, they're coming to get us, they're going to take us away, it's a terrible thing, we can't have that. And they tend to hold up the Branch Davidians as their icons. You know, these, they're martyrs. But here's where it gets really interesting. As Steve Johnson notes, the Oklahoma City bombing split the radical right. Split the radical right. He says lots of militia groups were put off by the Oklahoma City bombing. He's quoting Cliff Van Zandt here, the chief negotiator for the FBI at Waco, who now works with MSNBC. Immediately after the attack, the FBI used that revulsion, the right wing extremists were revolted by Tim McVeigh killing all those people. Used that revulsion to its advantage, meeting with the extreme right wing groups and asking their help to identify what Van Zandt calls the fringe of the fringe. And what happened? Says Van Zandt, this is the former FBI guy, chief negotiator for the FBI at Waco, quote, a lot of people in those militia groups responded. He says, I think these things frighten people greatly. Potok says, many people began to revise their views on what the militias were all about. A lot of these people were just out, you know, they're going out with their guns and they're doing target practice and they think they're patriots. And then one of their bunch blows up the Oklahoma building and they go like, whoa, wait a minute, let's rethink this. Same thing happened with a lot of Muslims after 9/11. We could have used that. We didn't. Bush blew it. And now we're reaping the consequences. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vasily Karaskin. I'm the president.